Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
And we are live at The Pint until 2 o'clock today. Downtown Jasper and 109th. You can email us at nationradio at theteam1260.com. And we welcome you to tune in to Nation Radio every Saturday. Our focus, Oilers past, present, and future, plus the NHL's biggest stories every week. Our guests today include Ian Walker from the Vancouver Sun. We'll talk about the Canucks, the Preds, and that unusual Game 1 in the series. Hopefully it'll be more entertaining for Game 2. I think part of the problem is the first round, all eight games were so good. And maybe one of the best ever. And it's going to take a little while, I think, to get into these new series, especially the Vancouver one, because it was a flat game. Todd Nelson from the Oklahoma City Barons will join us. We'll discuss the playoff run, the best Barons moving forward, and how coaches exit for the summer and what they do before they go. Emails, including one about Stu McGregor that has me thinking, and I'd like your input. And in hour two, Scott Cullen from TSN is using advanced stats. We'll talk to him about that, about the Edmonton Oilers article he wrote this week, and the draft this summer as well. And if we have time today, Anton Lander signed this week. We'll talk about that, and if we have time, we'll also roll an interview he did with the Team 1260 this week, a little bit about what he's looking forward to, about his season, how he felt everything went with the World Junior Championships, and how he's looking forward to coming here in the fall and hopefully earning a spot with the Edmonton Oilers. Very busy weekend after last night, Tampa Bay up 1-0 over Washington. Steve Yzerman, boy, he made some good bets this year at the deadline and then pre-deadline. Intelligent decisions, making his team basically on a collision course with the Final Four. He could be in there. A great game against Washington last night. It's possible the Bolts can meet Detroit in the Stanley Cup Final, at least so far. And Dwayne Roloson, what a pickup. Brewer looking good, too. And that team is on fire. I love their post-game media conferences. Both coaches are doing really well. San Jose won in overtime over Detroit last night. I thought Howard was the key there. Vancouver ahead of Nashville heading into tonight's game. And Boston-Philly gets started in about an hour from right now this afternoon. So, Jordan Eberle scored twice for Canada in the World Hockey Championships in a 4-1 win over Belarus. Germany surprised Russia 2-0. I think Canada plays like France or Yemen or somebody. It's a low, low level team that they're playing next time around. Oilers signed Lander. We'll talk about that. He played 18 minutes a night in the Swedish Elite League. As a team leader and as a teenager, won close to 50% of his face-offs. His Desjardins equivalency around 34 points in Andrew Cogliano territory. So I think he's going to be a guy that we might want to think about possibly making the NHL team in the fall, although he definitely is an option for Oklahoma City as well. That and more coming up today, and as I mentioned before, we welcome your emails anytime here on Team 1260 and Nation Radio. It's Nation Radio at theteam1260.com. Yesterday, I got a chance to spend a few minutes with Ian Walker from the Vancouver Sun and talk about all kinds of interesting things. We began talking about his Twitter account, which is Walker Big Talker. It's quickly becoming my favorite. I didn't know if I'll ever see a big hip check like that again.
Well, you know, it's one of those things. I'm pretty fortunate. There's about 8,200 people who find some sense of humor and maybe a little bit of insight and hopefully are entertained by me a few times a day. I really try to take a little bit of a different approach. I think a lot of people can just put stats relate information from practices and things, which I think is important. But I like to show a little bit of side of my character and my personality. And, you know, I get to go to places and be at things that I think a lot of people maybe wish they could, too. So I'd like to take the people with me and just sort of take them on my journey. And at the last of things I want to do is take myself too seriously.
I like it because you reference Urban Dictionary a lot, and it saves me from going over there. So,
well, that's right. You got to be hip to be square, right?
I'm so that. Hey, last time we were on with you, I got all kinds of heat afterwards because I didn't ask you about Biff Naked enough. So I hope you don't mind. I got a couple of questions to lead with. Did you guys watch the Royal Wedding together?
No.
Okay. So my next question, what was she wearing, would not be of any benefit at all then.
My wife or Kate?
Your wife.
You know what? Her wedding dress was beautiful. I can tell you that much. And she had a nice little twist with it because I didn't really want to know much about it, including the cost. Yeah, I was surprised because at the wedding, it was she had the sleeves were cut off. So she had a lot of her tattoos showing. Mm-hmm. But it was a long flowing gown. And then at our reception, she happened to stand up on a chair and revealed that it turned into a miniskirt.
Wow. Very nice.
Yeah, very classy, very elegant, very very her.
Well, and I understand that, and I know too much about this, and we won't belabor it, but I understand it was rather traditional. It surprised the media that was there because it was more traditional than they thought it was going to be.
Well, you know, our the ceremony itself was at a church, and both our parents, my wife's family were missionaries, and they adopted her in India. When she was 6 days old. And then my parents are ministers with the Salvation Army.
Oh, really?
So we wanted to, and that's probably, I think, was our biggest connection, was we sort of led these parallel lives where we grew up in these very religious homes, and then we both sort of rebelled and were the black sheep to the family. And she went off and shaved her head and grew a mohawk and joined a band, and I sort of left home at an early age to go off to school and pursue university education and things like that. And but we wanted to definitely honor our families that, you know, definitely played an impact in our moral structure anyways. And so we did the church service for them and our guests. And then the reception was at a Indian restaurant to pay some tribute to Beth's heritage in terms of her biological parents. What it was we didn't have the throw the bouquet, and we didn't have a DJ or a band, but we had a Bandra troupe come through. And this Bandra troupe played Indian music on all the sitar and all the different East Indian, you know, sort of instruments. And then we had a Bollywood dance troupe come in and perform for our guests. And it was a little bit of them and a little bit of us, and it really worked out really well.
That's fabulous. You know, if my wife is listening, she's like, and my husband can barely remember the date we were married, and look what you can remember these years later about your wedding. Good job, man.
Well, you know, and I also went and got it tattooed in Roman numerals on my wrist, so I'd never forget. So there's a tip for you.
Wow, man. Good job. Well, let's turn to what we're here to talk about, which is the NHL, hockey, and the Vancouver Canucks. Preds looked very flat in Game 1. As you pointed out, Barry Trotz was probably the most passionate Pred near the rink that night. Do you expect a lot more from them for Game Number 2?
I do, and you know, and I think... you know, a lot was made of the Vancouver Canucks and was there going to be sort of a hangover from their Game 7 overtime victory over their arch enemies, the Chicago Blackhawks. And, you know, there wasn't really. You know, Vancouver came in and played a good game. They had a lot of opportunities. If it wasn't for Pekka Rene, the game would have been a lot different than the score. But I think, you know, I think maybe what the media and maybe some fans underestimated is there may have been a bit of a letdown for the Nashville, who had never advanced to the second round before, you know, in their 13 years and have been to the playoffs, you know, last six of the last 7 years. So, you know, that's something that Barry Trotz addressed last night, too, was, you know, they can't be happy. They can't be satisfied with just getting to the next round. This is the highest form of hockey that this team has played in their history, and they definitely have to rise increase their intensity and their ambitions. Should they want to continue much further?
You know, one of the things that I was looking forward to this series, because, you know, you see Nashville as a team, and for somebody like the Oilers, they're a team that Nashville seems to develop defensemen wonderfully, better than almost any other NHL team. It's an opportunity for them to play on the big stage, and it was a disappointment, especially to see some of those really quality people like Shea Weber maybe not have the game that they were hoping for.
You know, as I wrote about today in terms of Barry Trotz being a great quote, especially after the sort of mundane one day at a time and things we were getting from Joel Quenneville and Alain Vigneault in the Chicago series, you know, I was impressed by Shea Weber for standing up and being accountable for his play. You know, he had a glorious opportunity in the final dying minutes, if not seconds of the game, and with a one-timer, with the net open, and he was the first to say, "Yeah, I don't know how I missed that one," and ended up burying it in the corner, was the first to say that everyone needs to look in the mirror, and no one played well, and he was the first to admit that he led that brigade. So I think that goes a long way, in at least they know they're not trying to kid themselves. You talk about defense, and I was fortunate to cover the WHL for a lot of years before I got on the NHL beat, and Cody Franson and Jonathan Blum, former Vancouver Giants, and so I know them very familiar with them, covering them since they were 15 years old. And I spoke to them afterwards, and there's a real parallel between the Predators and the Vancouver Giants, coached by Don Hay. And they always had this sort of mantra, will over skill, when the Vancouver Giants were doing those years where they had back-to-back Memorial Cup appearances, winning the Western Hockey League final one year and then winning the Memorial Cup the home the next year. And that was sort of their whole identity was they didn't really have the superstars, but they had a team that was going to buy into a system. They were going to play for each other. They were going to trust each other. And I think that's what Barry Trotz has built in Nashville. And that's what's going to have to definitely get them past the Canucks is will over skill.
You wrote a wonderful article on Weber, I think it was today or yesterday, with regard to his mom. Can you give us a little bit of the backstory there and tell those who haven't read it about Weber's situation?
Yeah, Shea Weber, again, I was fortunate to cover him, when the Giants were playing Kelowna and knew his mom was ill. But when Shea was 15, and again, Shea is a great story, went undrafted into the WHL and played on a couple of Memorial Cup teams and won one in Kelowna on home ice. And I knew his mom was ill. She was diagnosed with a brain tumor when Shea was 15, and so he was going off to Kelowna with his mom, fighting this life-threatening illness, and the doctors managed to remove most of the tumor, and for the next 5 years she led a relatively normal life and was able to see a lot of Shea's accomplishments and his brother's Brandon's accomplishments, and was there when Shea was drafted by the Predators in the second round, and was there when Shea raised the Memorial Cup over his head a couple of years later in 2005, I believe, and then shortly after Shea made the Predators in 2006, 2007, full-time, the headaches started coming back, and further tests revealed that it was the tumor had spread to a place in the brain that was inoperable, and chemotherapy and radiation was not going to be able to help the situation. So, of course, she was on medication and slowly started to deteriorate. Her short-term memory loss was impeded and then started to have violent seizures that soon became a nonstop. Just after the Olympics, which Shea is so grateful that his mom got to witness him win gold medal at Vancouver last February, shortly thereafter, doctors had to induce her into a coma, and with her husband and two sons at her side, she died in August of this summer. So, he's someone who definitely has grown up knowing how fragile life can be. Realizes how hard he's had to work to where he is, but also is wise enough to enjoy every moment, not take anything for granted. And I think when you go through that, I think there's a lot of people that go through cancer, and I can only speak for myself with my wife's diagnosis of breast cancer just a month or two after we were married. That once you go through something like that, it not just only changes the person that is inflicted by the disease, but it definitely affects those close to them, because you can't help but by osmosis take on a new belief in life and try to make the most of every day definitely become that much stronger, because if you're watching the one person that is most affected by it, battle through it. It's hard for you to complain about things at work or, you know, when the light changes too quickly at the stop sign or whatever else, you know. And so it was awesome to be able to talk to Shay about that. You know, we connected as being caregivers for people with cancer, and I was just really grateful for him to allow me to share his story, because it takes a lot of trust in a hockey player or in anyone to sort of let a stranger share their intimate details and about their families. And I only hope I did Shay and Tracy proud.
I believe you did. You wrote with real sensitivity, and it was a touching. For those who have not read it, you can go online to Vancouver Sun in Walker and just check on Shay Weber or Google if you want. It's a very, very well done story, I believe. Back to the Canucks here. What is the mood of the team after dodging the bullet with the Hawks and then a quick turnaround to play a game that they won, but there didn't seem to be a lot of energy in it? Was that the kind of game they needed, or did they just, you know, play just well enough to win?
You know, I talked to a couple of guys after the series, and you know, I think the best thing for them was to get right back on the horse, because they didn't have any time to sort of appreciate or get too big on what that win meant. You know, I think there was a real even, you know, I was talking to some people out in the city last night, and the whole town was sort of shut down for the game seven against Chicago. And then last night it was almost like it was just the regular season out at the bars and things like that, because I think everyone was so emotionally invested in that Chicago series. You know, but the players were saying, yeah, we had our night to think about it and enjoy it, and it was right back to work on Wednesday, and Thursday was the game. So I think it worked in their favor, because, you know, and one thing I don't know if your listeners realize, but you talk about a crazy 24 hours. Alex Burrows, who scored both goals in that game seven, took a penalty in overtime, and then came back to score the winning goal a couple of minutes later. Within 24 hours, was a father to his first child, Victoria, him and his wife had. So that was at 9 o'clock on Wednesday, so he had to shut her down soon after and get ready for tomorrow's game. So I think that's just a little indicative of what yesterday's game was like. I think Vancouver played well enough to win. It could have been a different story if it wasn't for Pekka-Rinne, like I mentioned, but it was hardly the emotional and intense sort of rivalry that that the Chicago series sort of really encapsulated a Stanley Cup final more than a first round series. But yeah, back to your question, I think this is something for Vancouver to build on. I think in terms of Nashville, at least they can tell themselves that they played probably their worst game of the playoffs and only lost 1-0 to the President's Trophy winners. So, yeah, I expect a different story in Game 2. I don't expect this to be a quick series. I did expect it to be a low-scoring series. You know, only time will tell in terms of where this goes. I don't think we've seen the best of both teams.
No, I agree. The thing that impressed me most from yesterday was actually after the game, where they were basically talking to the whole team, and I can't remember which Sedin was talking about, the fact that they really feel like they're going to come out of their slump. It's not like, you know, they're squeezing their sticks too tight, and there was a real calm about it. I think this team has really grown up in the last couple of years and are trusting that things will come back if they keep doing the right things. Do you agree with that, that they've grown up, they've more matured as a team?
Yeah, I think they've matured as a team. I think they've really have a faith and a belief in each other. I really think this is a team that all year has really balanced that fine line between emotion and non-emotion, where what I'm trying to say is, in terms of, they never let their highs too high and they never let their lows too low. And, you know, I've spoke with a couple of the guys off the record about this, and it comes down to, you know, from their beliefs. And I think the Vancouver Canucks are one of the leading teams in terms of going outside the box to think about different things. And their belief is, you know, if you can save energy worrying about not worrying about things, that's more energy you can put onto into the game. So by not letting their highs too high and their lows too low, they're maintaining a level course and they're maintaining an energy level that rides through the year rather than having to get up and get down or pick themselves up from bad performances, which they've had this year and they've had against Edmonton. Let's be honest, in the end of the regular season. So this is a team that really has taken on the identity of the Sedins. Henrik, their captain, and Daniel, two of the longer-serving Canucks. So, these are guys that are unflappable. They never see that get too frustrated. They've been dogged by questions by the media their whole careers, yet they stick in there. They answer it. They answer it as professionals. And I think you've seen that with there's been many stories this year in this market anyways about how Alex Burrows and Ryan Kessler have got away from the chirping, have got away from trying to get on the ref case. And again, I think that comes from your leadership group, which is led by the Sedins.
And a few more questions here, mostly to do with injury. Let's get an update, if I can, about Salo, Schneider, and if you've heard anything, I know he's not back this series, about Malhotra, how things are going and progressing.
Well, I'll start with Malhotra. He's around the team. We don't get to see him a lot. He's never really he put out a statement a couple of weeks ago saying that his vision has been restored in the eye, which is obviously a positive sign. But my understanding is that he's around the team. The team wants him around. He wants to be around them. He's an incredibly intelligent hockey player, and I'm sure they're picking his brain in terms of players and face-offs and different things like that. The hope and my prayers are that Manny is back next year. Corey Schneider took the day off after he was pulled or had to pull himself from game six with dehydration and then was back on the ice on Wednesday for practice. Thursday for yesterday's skate, and backed up Luongo and speaking with him. He seems fine. It's something that he's gone through in the past, and him and the trainers and the Canucks sports staff are going to try and tweak his drinks and fluids to maintain his just the things that go on with the body and adrenaline and sweating and all the things that come with being a professional athlete. And Salo, of course, we don't know much about. He's day-to-day, we've been told. He hasn't practiced since sustaining the injury. That's the thing about this depth on this defense. Sammy Salo goes out, and Aaron Rome and Keith Ballard and Andrew Albers are all there. So, it's really, you hate to say a non-story here, but it really hasn't been talked about a lot because of the depth that Vancouver has in its eight defensemen.
Final one here. Elaine Vigneault and Trotz, as a matter of fact, have been nominated for Coach of the Year. Was this his Vigneault's best coaching job this year?
I think it was in terms of he managed his players probably better than he ever has. He had a room that a lot of those guys had played for him before for a long time, and just like anything, you get comfortable with what you can and what you can't expect. And speaking with Roberto Luongo, LA is someone who micromanages. He lets his coaches do what they're hired to do, and that means Newell Brown with the power play and the specialty teams and Rick Bowness, who's been a head coach in this league before, with the defense, and of course the addition of Rolly Melanson as the goaltending coach to deal with Corey and Roberto. And I think that's probably been his biggest asset, is just having the faith in these guys to do their job and him coming in. And a couple of players were asked about that very question, and what kind of style does Alain have inside the room, and to their credit, they're like, that's for us to know and for you guys to try and figure out or guess, because we don't want to give anything away. And I get the sense that Alain has a deep amount of trust in his team, And, you know, even when they were down 3-0, obviously the voting is done before the playoffs, but even when they were down up 3-0 and then started to lose those three games to tie it, you never got a sense from him that he had lost faith or was outwardly angry with what was happening. And, you know, I think that goes a long way with players because, you know, just like ourselves, when we have a bad day at work, we're the first ones to know it, and the players are the same. And the last thing you need is your boss over your shoulder. You're telling you what you've done wrong. You just hope that they stand back and give you the faith that, you know what, not going to make the same mistakes twice. I think he's done that this year, and it's given him great results. My only hope is that, that he gets the credit for what he's done, you know, and I think that's not to limit what Dan Bylsma has done with Pittsburgh without, Crosby for a lot of the season. Same with Barry Trotz with a team that's, you know, he always seems to get the most out of the least in terms of his players. But you know, I think with the players that the Canucks have, I just hope that doesn't supersede what Elaine has done this year.
Walker, big talker, I'll be reading you. Make sure to make me look cool to my kids, okay?
Hey, no problem, and I appreciate the time. And, you know, I just want to thank your listeners for giving me the opportunity.
That's Ian Walker from the Vancouver Sun. Interesting guy. He writes some great articles. If you've never read the Weber story, is excellent, and he's doing a really nice rundown on that. What has been a slow series so far, but I imagine it'll be much better as they... Nashville's a hell of a team. They really are, and they could win that series. And you know what? They didn't show a lot except for their goaltender in game number one, but I'm sure it'll be a little bit different in the game tonight. Also today, at 1 o'clock this afternoon, the Bruins and the Flyers get underway. It'll be a very interesting contest. We'll update you throughout the day on that one. We're live at the Pine for Nation Radio and Edmonton Sports Radio, Team 1260, downtown Jasper and 109th Street. Until 2 o'clock today, drop by and say hello if you get a chance. You can also email us at nationradio@theteam1260.com. Coming up, we're going to talk to Todd Nelson from the Oklahoma City Barons.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
And you can email your questions to nationradio, team1260.com. We have Scott Cullen from TSN coming up in the next hour. And right now, you know, I was thinking about this on Thursday, driving down the road about the Edmonton Oilers and what they've gotten from the farm over the years. I remember the first farm team that they had in 79-80 was the Houston Apollos of the CHL. Al Rollins, a legendary name, was the coach. And from that team, Mike Toll, Ron Carter, Tom Rolston. The big name was Charlie Huddy, who had was an undrafted free agent. That was the year, I believe, they had like six rounds, so there was a bunch of undrafted free agents. Huddy was one of them, and he played in the minor leagues. And over the years, the Oilers have gotten a lot and sometimes not so much from their farm team. This year, I believe, everybody would have to agree that it was an absolute success. The Barons did have a chaotic season in terms of roster shuffle and still managed to make the playoffs and go deep in the series against a very strong team. So Todd Nelson joined me yesterday on the phone, and we talked a little bit about that. And the first question was that basically the coaching staff along with Nelson must be feeling pretty good about the team's success.
Yeah, I think so. I think from our standpoint as a staff, we're happy with what we got done. You know, we thought moving forward, like obviously one of our goals was to make the playoffs, and but then from there, you know, go a bit deeper than we did. But all in all, it was a pretty successful season. You know, we had quite a few guys go up and play up in Edmonton that did a really good job there. You know, Edmonton was so depleted with injuries that they needed bodies, and so like we had to keep the boat floating down here. And you know, like I thought, some of the guys we got coming in did a great job for us and got us into the playoffs. And but other than that, yeah, like I think all in all, it was a pretty successful year.
Was it difficult to get some chemistry when everybody came back down, the Petries and the Hartikainens and the Omarks? Was it difficult to merge that group with the group you already had?
Yeah, I think so. You know, like, you try to do your best with it. But, like, you know, like, going through that grind of the last five games of the season where we had a win 4 or 5, and that was really, like, when we were playing our best, you know, and, like, those guys were still up top. But I think through that stretch, the guys really knew, you know, what it was going to take. And I think when you get, you know, five guys back from up top, even though like you welcome them with open arms. You try to find the right fit, and you know, sometimes it's very difficult to do it within a 7-game series to try to get it going. But like we thought, we tried to make it fit the best way we could. But there were some chemistry issues. Not that the players weren't trying; they're all trying to play hard. But once again, like if you can get the right fit right away, it certainly helps out.
One of the things that I looked at as the season wound down and then into the playoffs, because somebody who's followed the Oilers farm teams for decades, really since the Oilers came into being, they really, this year specifically, I can't really name a player who was either a first-year pro or a second-year pro that didn't make a big step forward. And I know a lot of that is coaching, a lot of that is the player. But these guys really did seem to gel and improve as the season went on.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, with all the work that the Oilers are putting into these individual development programs, like for each player, I think the program is moving in the right direction, that's for sure. I think, you know, like having like a 3-man coaching staff down here certainly helps because we have more quality time to work with the players through video and also like on ice teaching as well. So I think like the model's, you know, like a great model right now, and I think the players benefited from that. But also, you know, like with the way that the program works, it holds the players accountable. So the players have to take it upon themselves to get better as well. So, you know, like just moving forward, I think it's like a step in the right direction.
When you are a coach and the team comes out and adds a player like Colton Tubert, who is somewhat similar in style to Alex Plante, did that give you any difficulty in terms of setting up the pairings and how you would play them? Because they're similar players, right?
Yeah, they are pretty similar. I think, you know, like we try to, you know, get the right fit once again, and we had Montgomery and Tubert playing together, and both those guys got hurt in the playoffs, and you know, I thought, you know, like going down, just looking back on it, that our team really missed Tubert the last few games. So, you know, like he's a big physical presence out there, and you know, Hamilton is looking over their shoulders every time he is on the ice, and you know, but like I think. Well, like with defense pairings, you can find out pretty quickly if they're gelling together or not. Like with lines, it's a bit different because you have just like one more body to work with. But it wasn't overly difficult. It was just more or less which guys are going to play in the special teams and go from there.
Is Tubert the kind of guy, like you mentioned about, you know, they're looking over the shoulder. Is he like a throwback, not a Steve Durbano, but an intimidator?
Yeah, I think, you know, he crushed a guy in game 3 and all of a sudden kind of put Hamilton back on their heels a bit, and it's too bad that he got hurt because he was having a great playoff series for us. But yeah, he is kind of a throwback player. He finishes his checks hard. He just makes guys pay the price in front of that, and also in the corners.
Now, at the end of the year, I imagine you have meetings where you kind of go over every player and send back reports, or at least discuss this player where he is and what kind of progress he made. Have you done that process now?
Yeah, we did that on Wednesday. We had our ace meetings. We talked to every one of the players. And from there, also Billy Morris is down here. He handles the individual development program. So it's like to get a double dose of, you know, like what I think they have to work on, you know, moving forward to next year, you know, like the same stuff, like make sure you put a good summer in by working out. And then also when they go talk to Billy, they kind of like refine it a bit and talk about some of the like the more detailed things they have to work on. So I think that, you know, like from the players leaving here, they have a good idea of what they have to do in the summertime to help them just give themselves a good chance to try to make the Oilers next year.
Do you know, I'm not asking for specific names, but do you know in your heart of hearts when you're doing that exit meeting, guys that you're going to have back and guys that you may never see again?
Yeah, we do. You know, like there's going to be a turnover, like there always is. Some players want to explore different opportunities and go elsewhere. You know, and then there's also like our decisions of, you know, like we have players coming up that are younger, and we have to try to make room for them as well. So sometimes it is a kind of, you know, like a pretty difficult thing. But you know, like it's a situation where, you know, like also in those meetings, like we have feedback from the players too. Like, you know, like we want to get some feedback on how they were treated here. And all in all, I thought the meetings went very well. It was very positive.
When you look at this team, and one of the things that I noticed from Springfield to Oklahoma City from the organizational point of view was the importance of those AHL veterans like Giroux or Jake Taylor, not necessarily those names, but how important is it to have two or three of those guys who really can help the newer players adjust and maybe take some of the heat off in terms of matchups?
Well, I think it's vital. You know, like you have to have one of those, or like have a good group of veteran players. Like the league is very young. A lot of these players are just trying to figure things out on their own. Like even away from the rink, like cooking for themselves, and just trying to adjust to the lifestyle. And so I think it's very important. And that was one of the things that was mentioned by a lot of the younger guys, that you know, like how it was nice to have some veteran guys around here just to show them the ropes. And you know, I thought our veteran guys did a really good job with our young guys.
Hartikainen, Omark, and Petrie really came up and they really impressed. Would you say that was the cream of the crop in terms of the AHL to NHL step, or were there anybody else that you would include in that group?
No, I think that you hit it dead on. Like those guys are, you know, like we can classify them as blue chip prospects. Those are guys that really developed well and also like made an impact up top. And you know, moving forward to next year, like we had a lot of other guys that went up there that did a good job. You know, but like right now, it all depends on what kind of summers they put in. Like, but they have to come to camp ready to go, just ready to go. They have to have the right approach. And if those players do get sent back to us next year, obviously like they're gonna have to prove themselves again. But I think those three guys are definitely knocking on the door to stay up there for the whole year.
Just a few names here of guys who were signed and sent to you late in the season. I want to get your impressions, beginning with Hunter Tremblay.
Played very well for us. Didn't know much about him, but everybody liked the way he played. I could tell from his first practice that he was going to be a guy that I'd want to have in the lineup in the playoffs. And, he does everything really well. Like, he plays his position well. I can use him at power play or penalty killing. He was a nice addition. So he played very well for us. He scored a big goal for us at home. And, he's a guy moving forward that, it's going to be pretty new to him going to an NHL camp, so it's a situation where, he has to, put a good summer in, make sure he's in great shape, and looking forward to working with him next year.
What about Brandon Davidson?
He played just the one game in the playoffs, but he kept things simple, and also, offensively, he had a pretty good knack of getting pucks through. I thought he, played very well. He kept it simple out there, and was very efficient.
And final question on Tanner House.
Tanner House, he's a guy that he came to us and he prides himself in a shutdown role, but also when he was with us during that stretch, he made some great plays and had some solid contributions offensively for us. He's a very well-rounded player where he can play in both ends of the rink, and once again, having these two young guys that were added to us, it's a very positive thing moving forward.
The owners have signed several picks in the last few weeks. Anton Lander just the other day, Curtis Hamilton, Martin Marinson. Do you get scouting reports on those players or film, or do you just see them in the fall?
No, we get reports on them. We're all pretty good at communicating with each other. We know, we can talk to the scouts. We can talk to management about these certain players. So we have a pretty good idea, moving forward to training camp. Now it's just a matter of where do they fit within the organization. If they, if it's a guy that might get an opportunity to play up top, or is he going to be with us, or even in Stockton? We want to make sure that we have good depth in all three organizations. And so we're starting to see a lot of these younger guys come in here and doing a great job. So, we definitely know what we're getting. We just, have to do our homework and talk to our scouts. And, organization is very forthright in, giving us that information.
And for the coach, at the end of the year, I'm sure there's a little bit of golf and a little bit of time in the family. Do you take off on vacation now, or are there still more things to do with the Barons?
No, actually, we just finished up yesterday with the Barons part of it, where we had a little golf outing and we had a barbecue at my house. And so a lot of players are on their move back home. They want to get back. Some guys have, buddies' weddings that they have to go to and stuff like that. So right now I'm just going to kick back and try to enjoy some time off. I don't plan on going anywhere on vacation. I've been flirting with going deep sea fishing, but other than that, I'm just going to hang out and just try to relax here.
That's a pretty nice part of the world, isn't it?
It really is. I actually, we all got sunburned yesterday. It was 75 degrees, and it's, you know, like, it was a sunny day, and it was breezy, and I think everybody got burnt. Well, like, I know I did anyways, but it's a fun part. The people here are great, and the positive thing is I talked to all the players with their exit meetings, and the one thing that was common, they really enjoyed playing here in Oklahoma City, which is a good thing to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. Todd, thanks so much for this. You have a great day.
All right, thanks. Take care.
Oklahoma City Barons head coach in a very successful year. The team made the playoffs despite all kinds of chaos with regard to call-ups. And as he mentioned in the interview, Hartikainen, Omark, and Petrie, the blue chippers, definitely came through, and they could play at that level. And I think that gives us a little insight into what we might expect from Anton Lander, who's coming over from Sweden after playing in the SEL for several years. Hartikainen did very quickly, as did Omark and Petrie. So it's going to be an interesting year next year. But the other thing that I really liked was that the Oilers do have some communication going on with regard to Lander or Hamilton or Marinson. And that's a key, too, because the coach is already thinking about next year and how he's going to plug them in, and possibly someone like Abney might appear in Stockton to start the year. And it looks as though the Edmonton Oilers are approaching this. If you can remember back to when they didn't have their own team, they'd farm some people off to Iowa or to Hamilton, and the AHL Oilers were maybe in three or four different cities at one time. This is a much better way to go, and I think Todd Nelson is a big part of it. Very successful year for a very fine young coach. So, interesting, and really enjoyed talking to him over the last little while. This is Nation Radio on Edmonton Sports Radio, Team 1260. We're live at the Pint downtown, Jasper and 109th. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to talk to Scott Cullen from TSN, who uses advanced stats. Had a great article on the Edmonton Oilers and their summer. We'll talk about that, and also about Anton Lander and his signing, and what it might mean to the Edmonton Oilers in 2011-12. Coming up, your emails.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
And we are live from The Pint this afternoon, 12:51, 9 before 1, in that Bruin-Philly afternoon tilt. It's going to be a great game. Two really good hockey clubs who could go to the Stanley Cup Finals, and I think there's going to be several of these series that go seven games. The Vancouver-Nashville game, I think, will go six or seven. San Jose-Detroit, you have to think it's going to go very deep. And the Washington-Tampa Bay series, that was the one I thought Washington might win, in five or so, but apparently I was wrong for the first time again. But it's four really good semifinals that we have right now in each conference. Coming up later on tonight, Vancouver will play game two against Nashville, and hopefully we'll see a better game there. We've got lots of emails to get to from last and this week. We invite your emails all the time at nationradioteam1260.com. This is from Danny. He said, after playing 74 games with the Bruins in the regular season, Tyler Seguin hasn't suited up in the playoffs. I think I understand why. Inexperience, good depth on the bottom six. Two questions. Barring an injury, do you think we'll see him play in his first postseason game? And hypothetically, if the Oilers had drafted Seguin and the Bruins Hall, do you see Hall watching from the press box like Seguin is doing this April? The answer is I don't think he'll play, because it's a difficult position to put a player into. The playoffs are now at the point where if you make a mistake and you lose the game, it's a huge deal, especially against a team like Philadelphia. With regard to Hall was more NHL ready. I think most people felt that way, and he certainly proved it during the regular NHL season. So I do think it would be a different situation if Taylor Hall were a member of the Boston and Bruins. I have another question in that regard from Mark, saying, if Ryan Nugent-Hopkins was in last year's draft, would he be selected before Seguin? Thanks for considering my question. Mark, Oil fan in Vancouver. Well, Mark, thanks for being an Oiler fan in Vancouver. I'm sure that's very difficult. Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, I think, would probably go behind Seguin. That's my opinion. I think he's a player who does have some question marks. Probably number one, and probably the guy the Oilers are going to take. He's a tremendously skilled guy, but his numbers, which is what we pay a lot of attention to on this show, suggest that he's a little shy of Seguin at the same time. Doesn't mean he won't be a better player. He obviously has some elite skills, but in my opinion, Seguin probably would have been number one overall had he been available in this year's draft compared to Ryan Nugent-Hopkins or Adam Larson. Hall for Oil asked this question: why do you call Stu McGregor the Magnificent Bastard? Well, it goes back to 2008, and it was with regard to Jordan Eberle, who was taken 22nd overall. Early that fall, he really performed well for the Regina Pats, and so we at the Low Tide blog got to calling him MBS, or Magnificent Bastard. And McGregor and the Oilers scouting staff, along with the management, seem to be able to get more out of each draft, or at least that's what I believe. And I think it's because they reach less in the top 100 picks. They still make them, Cam Abney, Troy Hesketh, but there are fewer and none in the top 70 so far in the 3 years that McGregor has been the scouting director. If we make a list of the picks the Oilers have taken in the range they were projected to go since 2008, that's Eberle, who was 22 on Bob McKenzie's list. They got him exactly at 22. Timo Hartikainen, they got a 163 overall, and he was number 25 European Central Scouting. So that means that he would have been projected to go between 65 and 70. So they definitely got a guy who wasn't a reach there at 163 overall. And you heard Todd Nelson talking about the fact that he was a blue chipper at the AHL level this year. In 2009, Magnus Pajärvi fell to number 10. And we all say, well, he just fell into his lap. But I remember years where the Oilers would have players fall into their lap and they'd trade down or they would pass over. The Mark Pouliot year is an excellent example of that. If you remember the draft that year, Zach Parise was available. They chose Pouliot, and I believe that Pouliot's injuries had a lot to do with how it turned out. But when you trade down, you really do become somewhat, you know, vulnerable as history rolls along and as time rolls out. This isn't meant to rip Kevin Prendergast. I've always said he was about average as a draft director. But when you're rebuilding and making lottery picks, you need to be way above average, and you need to definitely make a good decision. Stu McGregor's kids are tracking well. From 2008, Eberle and Hartikainen. 2009, Pajärvi and Lander. 2010, Hall, Pitlick, Marantz, and Hamilton, and on it goes. There was a very deep draft for them in 2010. I think it's going to be a historic one for Edmonton Oilers. You never know. Tom Edura found God, moved to the mountains, and the Colorado Rockies never heard from him again. But, and it is a crapshoot, but the Oilers now seem to be doing things right. They scout heavily. They have a lot of eyes on these kids. They go to the combine and interview everyone, and they draft a lot of combine kids. And I think that's a tell too. You know, in the next few weeks, we're going to get a list from the National Hockey League about who's invited to the combine. And last year, they invited 100 kids. The Oilers took 7 of them. And that includes Tyler Bunns, Brandon Davidson, Taylor Hall, Curtis Hamilton, Martin Marinson, Ryan Martindale, and Tyler Pitlick. Pretty much the draft list, the people that we're talking about right now. So these are the 100 best by consensus. The Oilers interview them, and they may go off the board a little bit with a Cam Abney or a Troy Hesketh. But for the most part, they're staying on track. Bob McKenzie's list, which was released the night of the draft lottery, is really a good tool, I think, not just for fans, but for NHL teams. He polls the scouting community, and his top 30 is tight, very close to the 30 names that will be called on that Friday night of the draft. So when any NHL team goes off the board and sends their fan base to Mr. Google looking for, you know, Jesse Niinimaki, the team might feel that he's the best player available, but a wrist injury, as has happened in Niinimaki's case, or an inability to put on weight, that was also a problem with Niinimaki. It leaves you a little bit vulnerable. I think the NHL draft is pretty sophisticated now. These scouts have a long look at everybody, and even in the last 10 years, scouting has improved, and I think the universal list that you see from somebody like Bob McKenzie is really a good guideline, not just for fans, but for NHL teams. So, with that in mind, on the Low Tide blog today, and also over at Oilers Nation, I'd love to get your input. Who do you think should get the most credit for how the Edmonton Oilers have drafted in the last 3 years? I know it's too soon to say, oh my God, they're fabulous and this is a historic draft, but it does appear to be tracking very well. So I'd love your input. You can email me between now and 2 o'clock, and I'd love to get you on the air, Nation Radio at theteam1260.com. You can also post it at Low Tide and also at Oilers Nation. Like your input. Who deserves the credit? Is it Tambellini? Is it McGregor? Or is it a combination of all the people involved, a tremendously large scouting department, both pro and amateur right now for the Edmonton Oilers? We'll be back in the next few minutes with Scott Cullen from TSN. We are Nation Radio on Edmonton Sports Radio Team 1260, live at the Pint.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by the Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
And we are here until 2 o'clock today, live at the Pine downtown, Jasper and 109th Street. You can email us at nationradio, team1260.com. And we welcome to our show from TSN, Scott Cullen. How are you?
I'm great. How are you today?
I'm very well. Before we talk about your Oilers article and advanced stats, I want to congratulate you on a killer mock draft last season. You had Hall at number one, Pitlick at 27, and you were pretty bang on a lot of those. Did you spend a lot of time on that?
Well, I don't know if I spent a lot of time overall, but it's not like I can claim any inside knowledge or anything. It's a matter of matching up, needs and players, and kind of relying on a little bit of luck when it comes down to it, really, at the end. But that it happened to that I hit on some Oilers picks is all right. I can't complain. Can't complain when I'm right, because I surely don't complain when I'm way off.
Have you started looking at this year's draft, or is that something you do more towards the end of the playoffs?
I'm starting to, but I would say I'm in the preliminary stages. It's as the season goes on, I kind of just keep a vague eye almost on what's happening on the draft boards. And now that the playoffs have begun, I've just kind of started looking at, all right, what do these teams need, and who's out there that might fill these needs.
You did a nice article as well on goaltending and save percentage for the teams that are still in the National Hockey League playoffs. Your insight was pretty interesting there. What do you think of the series as they've begun so far?
Well, I think what I found, and this was just kind of an idea that I had, and it came up almost really because of last year when Montreal knocked off Pittsburgh, and I looked at kind of the vast difference that they had in save percentage in the series between Jaroslav Halak and Marc-Andre Fleury. And so I thought, all right, well, let's try it for all the series in this year's playoffs and see what the expected goals for and against might be based on what a goaltender has done for their save percentage to this point in the season, including the first round of the playoffs. And what a team has done allowing shots for and against, and I think it certainly doesn't cover everything that's involved with the team. I mean, once you start taking into account injuries, some of these overall numbers aren't going to be quite representative. But it gives you a kind of a baseline, I think, to see which team might be favored, might have the upper hand going into the series. And so when I look at it, the early returns from the second round aren't terribly unexpected. I think Vancouver should be expected to have an advantage on Nashville. I do have San Jose. I picked Detroit to beat San Jose, but it's almost a heart more than head thing going on there. That I think San Jose has they have really great depth, and that they end up with a great shot differential as a result. And so even if they only get adequate goaltending, it means Detroit needs spectacular goaltending, I think, to come back and win the series.
How much of a wild card is Dwayne Roloson in that series against Washington?
Oh, I think he became a huge wild card in the series against Pittsburgh. When they were down 3-1, it didn't look like any real trouble for the Penguins, even though the Penguins really didn't have a lot of marksmen in the lineup. And then Roloson really shut them down over the last three games, and he finished the first round with the best save percentage in the playoffs. And certainly, who expects that from a 41-year-old goaltender? That the Lightning can get an adequate performance out of Dwayne Roloson isn't anything that's a revelation. But the fact that you get the guy who gives you the best save percentage in the first round, well, that's really a difference-making result. So if he can kind of keep that up, and maybe he doesn't keep a .954 save percentage for the second round, even if it's a .930 or .940, like something that's above the norm, that certainly gives the Lightning a chance to knock off the Capitals.
Well, any Oilers fan will tell you, as long as they don't employ Marc-Andre Bergeron on the defense, it'll be fine for them. So let's get back to the Oilers a little bit in the draft a little. They're only the second team in NHL history to get the first overall pick 2 years in a row, or at least Ottawa used two picks in a row in the 1990s. Do you think there's a chance the Oilers will move that pick, move down a little bit to get a little better pick or possibly a roster player?
Well, I think they have to keep that option open for them. I even last year when they had the number one pick, and there was talk before the draft about them trying to wheel and deal so that they could get the first two picks. And that was kind of like a last gasp thing that, oh, well, maybe they'd move Alex Hemsky and then get the first and second pick and really not worry about the Taylor or Tyler debate, just take them both. I think they would have to consider moving out of that pick. But at the same time, if everybody's top guy, and I don't know that anyone has come to quite a consensus on it yet, but if Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is a guy who people are going to expect as a top pick, well, he's a playmaking center, and it's not like the Oilers are overrun with playmaking centers. So that seems like a decent fit to me.
On April the 27th, you wrote a really good article on the Oilers and the summer game plan, and two things caught my eye. Let's start with advanced stats. Whenever I see things like shot differential, my ears perk up. What are the advanced stats that you value the most and use when you're evaluating a player and a team?
Oh, I think it varies from situation to situation, and so what I mean, as you know from my article, I go to that site behindthenet.ca, where Gabe Desjardins does this fantastic work digging up some of these, I guess, more involved stats, the things that you're not going to find on the back of the hockey card, and it gives you a better insight into what a player is doing. And in the case of that article, I know I wrote something about Linus Omark, because Omark had a minus 16 rating in 51 games, and on first glance you look at that and go, oh my gosh, that's terrible. And the advanced stats, the shot differential that came out of it, is you find out that Linus Omark actually had a positive shot differential. It was the best among Oilers who had played 50 games. And so, you know, maybe Linus Omark isn't the world's greatest defensive player, but the fact that he has such a positive shot differential might indicate he's not the awful defensive player that the plus-minus would tell you right off the bat. And so I don't think any of the advanced stats are kind of a catch-all that, oh, you just look at this number and then you know what value a player has. But I think when you start applying them into certain situations, you get more insight. You're going to know a little bit more about it. And so in the case of Omark, I would look at it and say, well, yeah, he probably does need to improve his defensive play, because I'd still like to see a guy who's not minus 16 in 51 games. But at the same time, I'd be willing to give him that chance to improve on it, because, yeah, the shot differential wasn't that bad. And, you know, as the rest of the Oilers continue to get better, you would figure Omark's numbers will also get better.
I like it, and I agree with you totally. And I like that shot differential stat, because it really does match what we often see with our eyes, where we see a kid with minus 16 and we're like, man, I think he's better than that. And he really is difficult to get off the puck. Once he has it, he really can maintain possession. And he does things that we don't associate with a poor defensive player, although he's still young and he's on the wrong side of the puck a lot. So it's interesting insight that you pass along. When evaluating a player, do you factor in time on ice and quality of opponent as well?
Well, I like to, and that's kind of, I think, almost the evolution that's just waiting to be explored in advance. I know they do have a lot of the quality of competition and things like that are terrific. I went to the Sports Analytics Conference this year in Boston, and there was a guy who was doing plus minus there, but it was all based on strength of competition as well, the way he was weighting the plus minus. And the results gave you, I mean, you don't want to create a new stat that totally turns the world upside down and all of a sudden tells you that Pavel Datsyuk and Sidney Crosby are terrible players. You're not trying to find a stat that does that. You want a stat that sort of verifies, you know, the players that we all know are the best players. You still want to know that they're the best, but maybe other guys will slide their way up into that leaderboard and you kind of go, oh, well, maybe there's more value to this player. And so when I was looking at the strength of competition that he uses in that, I think, like, that is of huge value. Knowing, you know, the matchups that a player's against. And a guy like Nicklas Lidström, everyone would suggest to you that Nicklas Lidström has, you know, he slipped because he had the first minus year of his career, and maybe he has. He's maybe not the Nicklas Lidström that he was at his peak. He was also taking on the toughest opposition in the league on a night-in, night-out basis. So, you know, yes, maybe Nicklas Lidström isn't at the peak of his career, but he's no slouch. He's still getting, you know, the hardest minutes available.
And he's a guy who, I think if we look at NHL history, guys like Doug Harvey and Tim Horton, those defensive players often can play into their 40s and be very effective because they're so darn smart when they don't have the puck.
Oh, and Lidström has almost become a master of, you know, being very efficient in his movements. And, you know, even with the goal he scored last night, it only required a quick burst from him to get off the blue line and get open to score that goal. But, you know, the rest of the time, Lidström can play his angles and keep himself in good position. And as you say, it'll, you know, allows his career to go much longer. And, I mean, heck, even in when I'm playing pickup hockey, I find it a whole lot easier playing defensive my age now.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm not going there. You know, it's too far. One of the things that I've learned from advanced stats in the last couple of years, and this is just an aside, it's not really going anywhere, but when Craig McTavish coached the team, he was really a hard line matcher. And as Quinn got the team, and now Rennie, who's basically just in development mode, it becomes very difficult to gauge toughness of minutes, specifically for forwards, when you're rolling four lines. And I think that's one of the things that hopefully we can find a solution to as we roll on here and experience advanced stats and add to it and figure out exactly what's going on. With regard to the Oilers, you talked about nine rookies who played a dozen or more games this season, most of them quality players, Hall, Pyarvi, Eberle at the lead. How good do you think these kids are as a cluster, as a group moving forward?
Oh, I'd be quite encouraged if I was an Oilers fan looking at this group. And that, you know, I'm not saying this just because of my Edmonton radio. This is, Hall, I think, and he started out a little slow, but I think by the end of the season it was pretty clear that he has the chance to be a real game-breaking scorer. I mentioned in the article that I could see him being a 40-goal guy, you know, on a yearly basis, and that is, you know, maybe Taylor Hall's a 50-goal guy, and I'm undershooting, but I think, you know, if you're looking at today's NHL and you call somebody a 40-goal scorer, that's there's only a handful of guys doing that every year, and I think Taylor Hall has that kind of ability. So, you know, having him at the top of the class certainly helps. But even the development of a guy like Magnus Pajarvi and Linus Omark, I think that kind of gives you nice depth in the organization. And honestly, late in the year, I really liked what I saw from Teemu Hartikainen.
Yeah.
I know he only played a dozen games, and it's really just his first year in North America, and maybe those dozen games weren't terribly important given where the Oilers were in the standings. But I thought he totally looked like a keeper. And so, you know, if you're pulling, you know, that many guys in their, you know, rookie year and getting contributions and that you expect to go forward and continue to build on, well, I think that's, you know, really what any team that has gone through struggles, what they're really hoping to achieve. And so I think the Oilers are off to a good start in that regard. And, you know, with the first pick this year, hopefully they'll add another piece to the puzzle.
Help me with this, because one of the things that I'm trying to figure out in my own brain is, with the improvement, and I agree with you, I think Taylor Hall could score 40 goals. He's got that kind of talent, and he really came on late. And with these other kids, if they stay healthy and maybe add a defenseman or maybe a center who can win a faceoff, how do you project that into the future for next year in team wins? Is there any way to do it? Because, you know, I mean, I can say, hey, they're going to win 35 games next year, but that's a lot of improvement in a National Hockey League season.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I don't know. I think there are plenty of guys, and I think some of the people at Hockey Prospectus are probably closer at trying to identify, okay, if you add this, it'll equate to this many wins in return. And I don't have really a firm grasp on, okay, if you bring in a guy who all of a sudden is 60% on the draws and he's replacing guys who are, you know, 44 and 45%, how many more wins is that going to be worth at the end of the year? I mean, honestly, if it's just an improved faceoff man, that might be worth a half a win a year. It's really hard to quantify what kind of value you're going to get out of that. So I think, and part of the interesting thing is with the Oilers, is they don't necessarily have to bring in a whole lot. I mean, they do need an upgrade on defense, and yes, they could use playmaking center. But part of what their improvement has to be is internal improvement, where all these guys have to, you know, continue to mature and grow as players together. And hopefully it all kind of works in the right mix that they end up, you know, improving as a whole, at least as much as they are individually.
You talked about needs in the article, and we just did a minute ago, but size, acquiring players that are tough to play against. Are there a lot of kids who fit that description in this year's draft, or do you think the Oilers are better off going the trade or trade or free agency route?
Well, I think if you're looking for guys who are going to make an impact immediately, then, you know, I would certainly look to the trade and free agency. And if, you know, when you're looking at, okay, we might need somebody to go out there and bang a little bit because we have Hall and Eberle and potentially, say, Nugent Hopkins. These guys shouldn't have to fight their battles effectively. You know, you need somebody else to go out there and do the fighting for them, or even just, you know, policing the area. And if you look, say, what Tampa Bay has done, when they brought in Ryan Malone to play alongside Steven Stamkos for quite a bit the last couple of years, and not like Ryan Malone is a heavyweight who's taking on every tough guy in the league, but he sort of, you know, rides shotgun out there and keeps things in control for Stamkos, so that he's not getting abused out there too much. And so I think the Oilers could use somebody like that, and, you know, it doesn't have to be Ryan Malone. It could be any number of guys who are you know, even a guy who's a checking forward, who every once in a while you can move up for a shift or two to play that role. Because as much as the Oilers have these skilled guys who are young and entertaining, at some point when you want to make the jump to, from being a interesting team on the rise to being a real tough, you know, a tough out in the playoff, well, then you have to have some guys who are real hard to play against. And right now when I look at the Oilers roster, there just aren't a lot of those players.
Yeah. Now, I want you to choose this answer very wisely, because one of the real frustrations for Oilers fans right now is that because we're far away as a group, you know, as fans from enjoying what, say, Vancouver is right now, the Oilers often call upon the Detroit model or the Chicago model as comparisons to this build that we're having in Edmonton. What kind of build does it look like from where you are? Is it a build that makes sense, or do you see some large cracks in the rebuild?
I think it makes sense. What I find, I guess, interesting is that a lot of the teams that are doing the rebuilds now are really, they focus on center and defense. And you know, if they can get reasonably priced goaltending, that also helps. But when I look at the Oilers really have a lot of their talent is on the wings. And so I think that they still could use, you know, I guess, more strength down the middle. And I guess if you had thought Sam Gagner, when he scored 49 points as a rookie, that he still wouldn't have scored more than 49 points now, you might have thought, okay, well, Sam Gagner was a guy that they thought was going to be a point-producing center for them. And certainly Sean Horkoff hasn't turned out the way the Oilers might have hoped when they signed him to the contract. So yes, I do think that, yes, they need some more help down the middle, and whether that's Nugent Hopkins or somebody of that ilk, sure, that they definitely need that. And they definitely need help on defense, because, healthy Ryan Whitney will go a long way next year, I think. But the rest of the guys, I think, are entirely questionable. Like Tom Gilbert, I could easily take or leave Tom Gilbert, whether he's part of the future of the Edmonton Oilers or not. And I think that's what the model that you see what's going on, say, on a team like Chicago, is they got the strong centers and they got strong defense, and then they sort of work in the pieces around it. Right now, when I look at the Oilers, I see that they have the pieces that you would surround strong centers in defense.
That's a really good point. Now, for those who are too lazy, even though I'm telling them to go see your article on the Oilers on TSN, you had a great list of possible free agents, Reisner, Kopechki, Ponikarovsky. Maybe run down some of those names that you think might fit the Oilers mold, and maybe some of the ones that you didn't mention that you think might also fit.
Sure, and this goes right back to the point of, you know, some guys with some size who are going to be tough to play against. And then when I mentioned guys like Ponikarovsky and Kopechki, I mean, they're not you know, bruising guys who are going to go out and drop the gloves night after night. That's really not their role or what they've done. But they're guys who have size. They're huge wingers, both of them. And they can bang in the corners, and they can, you know, create a little space out there by doing that. And if you look kind of further down the depth chart, I mentioned guys like Adam Hall and Marty Reisner. Both of them are very good faceoff guys. I mean, no one's going to get terribly excited if the Oilers go out and sign Adam Hall or Marty Reisner. But for a team like the Oilers, who really need help in the faceoff circle, you know, maybe those are guys who can help. When it comes to the blue line, I think they need somebody who is a real reliable stay-at-home guy. And the names that I threw out like Jan Hayda, who seems to have really developed since leaving Edmonton. He had some real success in Columbus as a shutdown kind of defenseman. And I don't know whether whether the Oilers would be interested in bringing him back, but a player of his, you know, of his skills is kind of what they could use, a guy who's going to be able to play on that shutdown pairing. And Radek Martinek of the Islanders, Milan Urchina of the Islanders. I mean, I'm offering these guys out as possible suggestions, also because I don't think they're going to, you know, you're not going to have to break the bank to get them.
Yeah, good point.
The Oilers aren't in a position where they should be throwing huge money at a free agent defenseman. Right now, you're still trying to build with this team, and you don't want to tie yourself up financially because you went out to get, like, Scott Hannon or somebody like that, who's really kind of a guy who should be bouncing from contender to contender at the moment.
Scott, I enjoyed this very much. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, anytime. Thank you very much.
All right. Scott Cullen from TSN. As I mentioned, he has a very interesting Oilers article up this week, and also one on goaltending in the final eight in the National Hockey League playoffs, and somebody very much worthwhile reading, and obviously a very interesting interview. It's 22 minutes after one. We are Nation Radio and Edmonton Sports Radio Team 1260. We're live at the Pint downtown, Jasper 109th, and we're coming back right after this.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Lowtide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
And we are live at the Pine until 2 o'clock today. Your email is welcome, nationradio at theteam1260.com. Boston up 1-0 now on Philadelphia. Connor, it was Krejci, and who got the assists?
Horton? It was Seidenberg and
Horton,
actually.
Yeah, I think it was Seidenberg and Horton. So
Horton, yeah, it was.
Yeah,
Horton.
Those are three guys that Pronger will have on his main list. So look forward to that. It's going to be I'm really looking forward to this series. Big time Boston fan since Bobby Orr. And it's been heartbreaking since 1972. But this is the year, man. That's one of the series that I'm really looking forward to watching. And Krejci almost scored again. It's going to be good. Spoiler, posted this on the Low Tide blog. THN Hockey News draft issue just out. Here's their top 30, courtesy Kirk Ludicky, who you know from Bruins Draft Watch here on Nation Radio. Here are the top 10. I'll run through them very quickly. Ryan Nugent-Hopkins at number 1. Adam Larson at number 2. Gabriel Landeskog at number 3. That seems to be the universal top 3. It might be in a different order, but those are the three everybody talks about. Sean Couturier at 4. Jonathan Huberdeau at 5. Ryan Strome at 6. Ryan Murphy at 7. Sven Barchi, a little bit of a surprise, at number 8. Zach Phillips, another slight surprise, at 9. And Dougie Hamilton, who I have seen slip a little bit in the last few mocks or top 30s that I've seen. He is now at number 10. I think some of that has to do with the fact that a lot of his points are acquired on the power play, and maybe people think he's not that offensive defenseman that maybe they thought he was a little bit earlier. Earlier in the week, I believe Thursday, great conversation between Anton Lander and Bob Stauffer. Took a little minute to congratulate him on the signing with the Edmonton Oilers and looking forward to the future. And here's that interview now.
Joined on the line from Sweden by Anton Lander. Anton, you're on with Bob Stauffer here in Oilers Lunch in the Team 1260. Congratulations on getting your deal done. How you doing?
Thanks a lot, sir. I'm really good. I'm really happy. That's a, how do you say, dream about when he was a little kid. So I'm really happy.
You were a second-round draft choice out of Timrå. Magnus Pjärvi went in the first round. He was with the Oilers this past season. We dealt with Magnus on a daily basis. How closely did you follow what Magnus was? Maybe get a bit of a gauge as to where you might be fitting in long-term in the Oilers organization.
I talk a lot with him, how he feels, the social life and the hockey, of course, and you want to say good stuff about the organization, Edmonton Oilers, that they take care about him and really good. That it really has to be one of the guys in Edmonton Oilers. So I'm really proud to be one of the guys in Edmonton, and I look forward a lot to come to camps.
Okay, Anton Lander joining us in Oilers Lunch in the Team 1260. Gets a three-year entry-level contract signed today with the Edmonton Oilers organization. Anton, how would you assess your season this year with Timrå?
It was a tough season, but we went up to the 10th place of 12 teams, and we missed the playoffs, and that's really bad now when it goes like 2 months, that one game can, if we win one game in November or something, we'll get the playoff spot. But we finish the stats that we don't can play down a level. So, but I'm really pissed off that we missed the playoffs right now.
Well, and that's a good thing, because I don't know if you want to add a lot of players to your organization that are happy that their team missed the playoffs. Anton Lander joining us here. Anton, we saw you at the World Junior Championship, I thought you were one of Sweden's best forwards, one of Sweden's best players. You're the captain of that team. How would you assess your performance and your country's performance in that tournament?
That was a tough tournament. But we make some good games that we win against Canada, win against Russia. Was the first place in the series. And then we lose against Russia on the penalty shot that I miss on the crossbar, and that finished the tournament. So it was a tough time, and I'm not happy with my performance that tournament. I feel that I can do more for the team. But I have learned a lot, and I will never say no to take a penalty shot again. That I like that situation when we can even be a hero, we can be the loser. So maybe next time it can be the good thing, but we're not happy, the contrary, to be fourth place in the tournament.
Could you believe how that tournament ended with Canada and Russia in that gold medal final? Canada blowing a three-nothing third period lead?
That was unbelievable. I watched the game on TV that I see Canada have the lead, and I turned off the TV. I don't want to see when we was the loser team, so I was 100% sure that Canada win, but it's never happened that Canada lose that game when they have the big lead. So that was a big surprise for me. So I don't know. It was a really fun tournament. A lot of Canadian people was there and watched the game. So it was a big memory for me in my life.
Anton Lander joining lunch in the Team 1260. Spent the last few seasons with Timrå in the Swedish Elite League. You were an assistant captain or a captain on that team this year?
I was assistant captain.
And you're only 20 years old, so that must speak volumes about the leadership skills that you have. How would you define yourself as a player? What type of player are you?
I'm a two-way player that I work hard in my defense play, and then I go offense and do my best. And the big thing for me, I think I work 100%. I want to win every single battle on the ice, even if it's on the board or middle of the ice. I want to win and bring some good situation for my team.
Yeah. Have the Oilers, you're coming to camp here to compete for a job right from day one as a centerman. You take a look at another one of your countrymen, Linus Omark, and Linus is a big deal over in Sweden, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a really good guy. He makes some really good stuff on the ice and pretty cool stuff too. I saw the first penalty shot he do that with a, I don't know how to say, but it was a really good penalty shot. And I meet him a lot here in Sweden in the Elite League, and he's a really skilled player. He's a really good guy.
Anton Lander joining us. I guess where I'm going with it, Anton, is Linus spent some time down in the American Hockey League to start the season, then he finished the year with the Edmonton Oilers. Magnus Pjärvi was with the Oilers the whole season. Obviously, in a perfect case scenario, you want to be in Edmonton for the whole year, but you know, from a headspace perspective, it is a possibility that you might spend some time in Oklahoma City in the American Hockey League. Are you prepared for that challenge if that occurs?
Yes, of course. I'm, like I say in the newspaper here in Sweden, that if I do something, I want to do it 100%, and I'm going to make it, how do you say, if I want something, I'm going to make it 100%, and work my ass off to make that I want.
All right. Just one final question for you. Bit of a softball. Who was your favorite Swedish player growing up as a kid?
Henrik Zetterberg, Detroit Red Wings.
So you're hoping that Detroit takes care of business against San Jose. What do you think of the Sedins in Vancouver?
Yeah, they have a really good season in the first, before the playoffs. One of the Twins win the points, and I think if they get a good start now, I think they can go along, but I hope for Zetterberg, he's on Timrå too, so I hope he bring the big win home to Timrå again.
All right, and I lied, I got one more question for you. How much would you dream of one day getting a chance to, you mentioned you're a two-way center, and as a two-way centerman, you got to shut down the opposition's best centers. How much would you like the opportunity to match up against, you know, Henrik Sedin or Henrik Zetterberg and go face-to-face, and it'd be your job to neutralize them?
That's a big question. That's the dream I have every night, so it's going to be a big moment if I do that. So Henrik Zetterberg is the guy I look up to every day when I was young. So I think I will choose Henrik Zetterberg.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. Have a good off season. Get training right away. We look forward to seeing you here in the fall. Congratulations on getting your contract signed.
Thanks a lot.
Anton Lander in conversation with Bob Stauffer earlier this week. Very interesting interview. Obviously a passionate guy and a guy who has no problem expressing himself about how he feels about coming to the Oilers, about how he felt about his season where he really struggled at the World Juniors and his team barely missing the playoffs. But he was a big part of the success that they did have during his time with Timrå in the Swedish Elite League. One of the interesting quotes that we heard about Lander at the beginning when he was drafted was from Stu McGregor. He said he very excited about Anton. He's a player we like as a potential second line center with for sure third line ability. Great face-off man, competitive at both ends of the ice. Smart, captain of the Swedish under 18 team. All our interviews with all of the Swedish players this past year, everybody spoke extremely high of him. Their leader was Anton Lander. And we know from Oilers drafting over the last several years that they really do look to intelligence and leadership, and Lander appears to have that. One of the things that I find interesting is that with Hartikainen playing a dozen games in the NHL, but mostly in the AHL during the year, and Omar being sent out, but only for a time before being called up, and Pajarvi playing here, I think we have three examples of what happens to some Euros when they come over here, like Lander will do in the fall, and it'll be interesting to see where he falls. The kid played 18 minutes a night in the Swedish Elite League. We understand against tough opposition for as much as we can tell. He was a team leader as a teenager, won close to 50% of the faceoffs, and his Desjardins equivalency is about where Andrew Cogliano's is. I'm not suggesting Cogliano would be the replacement. I'm saying that there's a chance that Lander will show enough in training camp to make this team, possibly at the expense of someone like Colin Fraser. The Oilers' depth chart at center right now might look like this. Horkoff, Gagné, Cogliano, Fraser at the NHL level, and then probably Lander with Van de Velde, Omara, Arcobella, and Kitnar, either signed or RFA this season, next season. I think Lander fits right on the bubble right now, and things could change. If the Oilers draft Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, then all bets are off. But then again, they might move Cogliano or Gagné over to the wing. So Tyler Pitlick may also be in there because the organization, despite the fact that he played in Medicine Hat as a right winger, has always said that Pitlick would project to be a tough two-way center in this organization. So it's very interesting. I think you could say that he's number five on the depth chart right now. With the skills that he does have, he could definitely impress enough. The bugaboo for all these kids is they have contracts that can be sent down. So the waiver issue becomes a huge deal, unfortunately, for these guys. And that's what happened to Linus Omark last year. So something to keep in mind. But I think that you know, as the spring comes along and you're doing your backyard and all that stuff, sometimes these little signings they slip through the cracks. But of all of them, of Hamilton, Marinson, all of the guys that have been signed in the last little while, I think Anton Lander is the guy to pay attention to. This is an individual who can play and played at a very high level last year, and early scouting reports had him compared to a Doug Jarvis type, which is an extreme shutdown defensive center. And my God, could the Edmonton Oilers use that guy? Philadelphia just scored to tie it. And they could certainly use that guy almost immediately. Might take some seasoning to in the AHL to be ready, but it's something to look forward to and something we can probably project happening in the next 12 months, similar to Omar or Hartikainen. A few other emails to get here, too. Andrew Young sends this in. Would it make more sense to trade down from number one and trade LA's pick up into the top 10? So looking at maybe going to number three and then having another pick later on in the top 10. If we could pick up a center like Ryan Strom and a defenseman like Ryan Murphy, I think this would be greatly beneficial and more beneficial than drafting a smaller, more skilled player like Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. And while at the same time taking a player in my mind with just as much skill, more size, and lower expectations than Ryan Strom, Murphy is going to be a sick offensive defenseman who would look great on the power play in Edmonton in a couple of years. Is this doable? Well, I think you'd probably have to add a roster player to it, but it's an interesting mix. If you're the Edmonton Oilers and you decide that Nugent-Hopkins is somebody that you can live without, or maybe that he'll be available to number three, remember that could happen too, and you could trade into the 8 or 9 slot, would that be okay? Can you come out of the top 10 with a forward and a defenseman that you like by giving up maybe the LA Kings pick and another roster player who you can afford to give up? And let's face it, the Oilers have lots of young players now. So That's interesting, and I think Andrew Young has hit on something there we'll talk about in the weeks to come. The draft is going to be very interesting, and because there's so many players of somewhat equal value, Steve Tamblyn, you might have an opportunity to optimize value with that first overall pick by maybe turning 1-19 into, say, 3-9 or something like that. Interesting, and something to keep in mind. This is from Dan Bissett. He said, I'm a huge Couturier fan. Do you believe there's any chance the Oilers pick at number one, considering his current ranking? I don't think so. I agree with you. I think he is the number one prospect that I would pick at the top position, just because of his wide range of skills. He's a defensive player. He's definitely established a certain level of ability in the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League. The problem with it is he may have been passed late in the season. He established his level of ability and played there for two straight years, and since then it's been more of the same, whereas Larson and Nugent Hopkins, and I would suggest Strome and some others, may have passed him. So the consensus is number six right now. I think the Oilers probably draft well before number six, and I doubt, honestly, whether it's going to be anyone other than Ryan Nugent Hopkins or Adam Larson. They may trade down, but they're going to make sure that they get the guy they want. Coming up before the top of the hour, we'll talk a little bit about the future for Nation Radio and the draft. Also, some very smart individuals who pay attention to the draft every year are going to be coming on in the next few weeks. We'll preview that and talk about some of the early lists next.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
We are live at the Pint every Saturday between noon and 2 right here on Edmonton Sports Radio Team 1260. It's Alan Mitchell with your emails. Welcome, nationradio at theteam1260.com. Spent a few minutes talking a little bit about Nation Radio, noon to 2 Saturdays, what you'd like to see, what we have coming up. We're going to do the Draft Day 2 show here, probably noon to 4, noon to 3, something like that. It'll be a very busy weekend for the Edmonton Oilers. The Friday night is round 1, but they're going to be obviously busy with at least one or two selections in round 2. And some trades likely. So we'll be down here live. Love to have you come down and join us as well. So some things to check out in the next little while. Stay tuned. We'll be talking about that in the next little while. Also, leading up to the draft, there's a lot of Edmonton Oilers fans who follow the draft very, very closely. If you're a member of the Logosphere, you know that Speeds from Hockey Symposium and Blue Bullet, who's posts on HF boards, are folks who spend like a lot of time looking at each year's draft and past drafts, noticing trends and evaluating and valuing players. And I think it's going to be a very interesting lead up to the draft. We're going to have those folks on, talking to them about why they feel particular players are going to be, you know, higher or lower. Their lists have a tendency to not look like everybody else's because they're evaluating based not necessarily on need or mock, but looking at what has value. And I think that if you follow drafts, if the NFL draft is on this weekend, it's very interesting. So many changes right now because there's no free agency. So a team like the Minnesota Vikings is picking a quarterback in the first round who maybe wouldn't have gone in the first round at all if there were no strike or lockout looming and free agency was readily available. They'd probably have Cobb from Philadelphia or McNabb by now. So these are folks who spend a lot of time looking at the draft, and we want to talk to them because I think their information has value, and I've been looking at it and observing it over several years, and they are very accurate folks when you look two or three years after the draft, which of course is more important than doing a draft to figure out how many players are going to go in your top 30. Brad McPherson is the gentleman who's known as Blue Bullet, and he sent me his top 15 list, so I want to pass it along to you. At number one, he has Ryan Nugent Hopkins. Number two, Adam Larson. Jonathan Huberdeau clocks in at number three. Gabriel Landeskog at number four. Dougie Hamilton at five. Sean Couturier at six, which I think is the consensus for him now. Looks like he's going to go right at the end of the lottery picks, around six or seven. Ryan Strome at seven. Ryan Murphy at eight. Murphy is holding steady. Hamilton is up and down, wavering a little bit, but Murphy seems to be holding steady around that 8 spot. Duncan Siemens at number 9. He's a Western Hockey League kid and a guy who's done very well as the season has progressed, and didn't really hurt that his team was had a quick exit in the WHL playoffs. He seems to be able to hang in there. Mika Zibanejad is a guy who's getting a lot of play after the under 18, and we're going to have Kirk Ludicky on for the Bruins Draft Watch in the next couple of weeks and talk about him and some other European kids like Joel Armia, a big Finn, who's an interesting player. Brad McPherson, Blue Bullet, has Nathan Bolo at number 11. That's fairly high for the player that he is. We'll get him on in the next few weeks to talk about that. Mark McNeil, who is a player we've talked about as a possible Edmonton Oilers pick at number 19. He's a two-way center, a bit of a power forward, and a guy who is definitely on the radar of any NHL team that has a need or somewhat of weakness at center. Armia is number 13 on Brad's list. Sven Barchi at number 14. He seems to have some cachet right now. Jonas Brodin is at number 15. That's Brad's list, Blue Bullet. If you missed it earlier today, the Hockey News draft issue is out. Their top 10 is Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, Adam Larson, Gabriel Landeskog, Sean Couturier, Huberdeau at 5, Ryan Strome at 6, Ryan Murphy at number 7, Barchi at 8, Zach Phillips, who's getting some play in the Q playoffs, he's at number 9, and Dougie Hamilton at number 10. My list is doesn't resemble anybody's. I still have Sean Couturier at number 1. I really do believe he's a player we're going to be talking about in the next 3 years or so as someone who should have gone at least in the top 3 along with Larson and probably Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. Doesn't look like he's going to go there, but there's a lot that you can talk about with Sean Couturier. Great face-off guy, a two-way player. He certainly played at an elite level in the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League at 2 years in a row. Would have likely led the Q in points again this year. Didn't, because he missed some time because he was on the World Junior team, the only draft-eligible kid to be on the World Junior team. So, lots of arguing still to come, and it doesn't look like I'm going to get my way, but that's okay too, because hey, you know what? The Edmonton Oilers know more about drafting than I do, and Stu McGregor will make the right choice for the Edmonton Oilers in late April, and I still think there might be a trade possible. Nation Radio and Edmonton Sports Radio, Team 1260, we're live every week at the Pint. We certainly enjoyed our time here. We'll be back next Saturday. I want to thank our guest, Ian Walker from the Vancouver Sun. A little bit about the Canucks, a little bit about the Preds. We also talked to Todd Nelson from the Oklahoma City Barons, and he passed along some of the kids that he doesn't expect back, including Jeff Petrie, Linus Omark, and Timo Hartikainen. We talked about Scott Cullen from TSN about the Edmonton Oilers and their summer plans, and some very interesting free agents that we might see coming this way, including Marty Riesner, who has always been a big favorite for Edmonton Oilers fans, and of course Anton Lander. Talked a little bit about his signing and looking forward to the fall. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Nation Radio, live at the Pint. We're back next Saturday. Make sure to join us.